2 Samuel chapter 8, beginning at verse 1. After this, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Methegamah out of the hands of the Philistines. And he defeated Moab, and he measured them with a line, making them lie down on the ground. Two lines he measured to be put to death, and one full line to be spared. And the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. David also defeated Hadazar, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadazar, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 men of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Aram and Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadazar and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Betah and from Behorihai, cities of Hadazar, King David took very much bronze. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadazar, Toi sent his son Joram to King David and asked about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadazar and had defeated him. For Hadazar had often been at war with Toi, and Joram brought with him articles of silver, of gold, and of bronze. These also King David dedicated to the Lord, together with the silver and the gold that he dedicated from all the nations he subdued, from Edom, Moab, the Amorites, the Philistines, Amalek, and the spoils of Hadazar, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah. And David made a name for himself when he returned from striking down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. Then he put garrisons in Edom, throughout all Edom. He put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. And Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. And Seraiah was secretary. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiadiah, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. And David's sons were priests. We live in a world in which you can get scared of what may happen in the world. We especially now, we hear of terrorism that's happening on our shores and in Europe. And one word that we learn new words. Word we've learned recently, last few years, are ISIS or Daesh. It's an organization. ISIS, these are the new terrorists. They replace what we would call the old terrorists. And if you know much about ISIS, ISIS stands really for an Islamic State. Their goal is to have what they call a caliphate. And a caliphate is a section or a territory that's ruled by Islam, by Mosaic, by Islamic rule. And the center of the caliphate is to have a caliph. A caliph is a ruler who rules, and they actually believe the caliph is the descendant or the one who inherits really what Muhammad was to give and to rule. We know that in the beginning of Islam, they extended their religion by extending their territory. And they had holy war. And that's, we know that old word from Islam, which we called jihad. Jihad means holy war. And so we, as we look at this in the world, whether you're a secular or whether you're of a religion, let's say like Christianity, we know that unless you're a radical Islamist, jihad is bad. They kill, they destroy, all in the name of their God. And what we can do, we need to be careful. It is true that their religion and their God is false. So whatever they're doing is false in that sense. But what they are doing and how they are doing should remind us of errors that we can do. As I thought about this, what about Christianity's history? Has Christianity ever entered into a holy war? Yeah, we think of the Crusades. They attempted. That was a time in church history, in world history, where the church identified itself with the secular state as a king or as a ruler went a certain religion. So everybody, it was in the land. The Christianity was tied to the land and to the king. And as you extend the land, and they wanted to free the Holy Land and make it Christian. That was not the Christianity of the first century, by the way, was it? You do not see the apostles encouraging the defeat of Nero or whatever ruler. They didn't side themselves to a land. I say all this to help us to consider what we read here in chapter 8. Because there's a sense, and what do we see here? We see here, in David's battles against the north, the south, the east, and the west, which we have here, by the way, don't we see kind of a holy war? This is important. For as we look at the Old Testament, as we look to read the Old Testament, there are two what I call major errors, and then there's what I've come to understand to be the right way of interpreting this. See, the one way we have a lot of people say, well, the Old Testament is dealing God with Israel as a nation, and therefore we as Christians have nothing to do with that. That's Old Testament. And they completely separate the Old Testament and New Testament. Then there are those who are attracted, really, that some of our people lean more to, where they identify them so much that we read the Old Testament for principle than how we ought to live. But they're missing. They're missing what God is revealing. We saw last week, or actually last few weeks as we looked at chapter 7. God had promised David this covenant kingdom. And we tried to show you as we've gone through those is that there's a sense in which David is a type, those are the word we use, that through David we see a prefiguring of his greater son, who would ultimately be the one who would fulfill all the to the great degree that God would accomplish. And I've been thinking about this and reading some other commentators and other preachers. I picked up a great idea to help us to maybe grasp what we mean by type or typology. I'm kind of older than many of you, but, and actually, I could say not as old as some of you, but that's getting less and less of a group of people. But when I was in high school, I took various elective classes. One of the elective classes I took, I don't know if many of you, if they have them today, I don't think they do, but I had a typewriter class. And I learned how to type on a typewriter. What was great about that class was we had the newfangled typewriters, electric ones. See, at home we had a non-electric one, you know. But to talk to today's generation, typewriters? What are those? There's actually a typewriter store right down the street. They should go to museums. See, now we have... by the way, when I was growing up, they actually... After typewriters, they actually had... word processors, and it was a dedicated word processor, but now we have these computers that do great things. But you notice something. What I learned on my typewriter class, how to type, is the same keyboard that we have on the computer, at least for now. Pretty soon the keyboard will go. But think about it, typology. A typewriter is kind of a type of the computer, isn't it? It's not quite as full or great of it. And that when we look at the Old Testament, that's what we need to see here. There's a similarity for a reason there. And so when you think of typology, think of typewriters and computers. If it doesn't help you, I'll just throw it away. But as we now, we're going to look with that as a way of introduction. We're going to look at David's. Primarily, we're going to look at verses 1 through 6, which is you see in the bulletin. But the reason why I read the whole chapter is not only for context, but there's another section here that's included, and you can see that, we'll talk about it, in verses 13 and 14. So if you want to know where our text is, it's verses 1 through 6 and then 13 and 14. You see, David does seem to have a holy war. Notice, as we look, just as summarizing the passage, David really has, in a sense, four battles, doesn't he? He has four battles, and verse 1, he deals with the Philistines, which are to his west. He deals with the Moabites, pretty much to his east. Remember, also the Edomites, really southeast. Both the Moabites and the Edomites are down to the southeast, and then you have those to the north, or even to the Syrians, even all the way up to the Euphrates is where the battle was. But the key thing to see in this text is its connection with chapter 7. Again, context. Look at chapter 7. Turn, if you're in the Pew Bibles, just turn a page backwards. And look at one of the key passages of this promise that God gave to David. We see it in verse 10. He says, "And I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place and be disturbed no more. And violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly." There is the full promise of that. We'll look at that. There's a full promise of that we'll see in the computer. But chapter 8 is a typewriter. How will the Lord bring them peace and in the land? Well, it's through the king. You see, immediately after this great promise, we're going to see, really in chapters 8 and through a number of these chapters, we're going to learn much about God's kingdom. We see it through David. But we as Christians need to read it because it's going to help us to understand the kingdom in connection to Christ. Connection to Christ. The territory that David does here, the territory. It should remind us of past, again, of the past in biblical history. It should remind us of the promise that God made to Abraham. Remember? He was going to give him the land up to the Euphrates, up to the river. See, that's what God promised Abraham and his descendants. We think of the great passage in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house into the land I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in your family, and in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Then in chapter 15, as God really signs that covenant, we read this in verses chapter 15, actually chapter 15, verses 17 through 18. "When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. And on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, 'To your offspring, I give this land, from the river Euphrates.'" I give this land. "From the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates." The southernmost and the northernmost. And then, of course, we know the Jordan, which is not near as far as the Jordan, all the way to the Great Sea. That's what God had promised to Abraham. And we know that he tells him, "I'm going to give this to you, but it's not going to be in your day." And he's going to bring judgment, the day of judgment, holy war, upon the inhabitants of the land, right? But he said that your descendants, that you will be for four generations in Egypt. And he gives them a reason why. What is the reason? The sin of the Amorites is not yet complete. And so as God's people come into the land, they're bringing judgment. And so God's holy war with Israel is holy war. I said jihad. There's a Hebrew word that we associate with holy war. And I know you want to say it. It's ham. Depends on how you pronounce it. I don't have the gutturals. But it means devoted to destruction. When Israel went into land, they were to devote the people to destruction because it was God's holy judgment upon a sinful people. And we see the conquest. And the conquest is done by Joshua. But when God gave them rest in Joshua to bring the holy war, he didn't complete it. He didn't give them the entire land. In Joshua chapter 23, the end of Joshua, Joshua summoned all the elders of Israel. And beginning in verse 2, he says this to the elders: "And now, I am now old and well advanced in years, and you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. For it is the Lord your God who fought for you. Behold, I have allotted to you as an inheritance for your tribes those nations that remain, along with the nations that I have already cut off from the Jordan to the great sea to the west. The Lord your God will push them back before you and drive them out of your sight, and you shall possess their land, just as the Lord had promised you." Notice, there's a conquest, but they weren't forced to the extremes of the Abrahamic promise. And of course, he tells them that if you're obedient, he will do this, but if you're disobedient, he won't. And of course, what do we see? Disobedience, the book of Judges. They never did. They were called to subdue and to eradicate some nations, But other nations they were called to subdue. Deuteronomy, I won't go there, but Deuteronomy 20, God tells them that of certain cities you go to, if they're not the ones that God devoted to destruction, then you are to offer peace to them. If they accept your peace, great. If not, then you are to attack them. But Israel's rest was connected to the judgment. Israel's extension of territory was connected to the judgments of those in those territories. And it's not until chapter 8 in David, after the Davidic covenant, after God, that we see actually David doing that. It is through the king that he extends the territory to what God had promised to Abraham. Let's look at verse 1. After this, what? After the covenant, by the way, he's not speaking here historically, because a lot of these battles are not necessarily chronological with David here. It's connected thematically. It's a summary of how God used David to accomplish his good pleasure. And so what? David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. Subdued, that word can mean to humiliate. But it also can mean, there's a positive side of that word used. Sometimes bowing, willingly bowing the knee to the one who is greater. But he subdued them. And then we have that interesting piece of information about the Philistine victory. He took Methegama out of the hands of the Philistines. Some of you might have translation of the mother city. It's a word that's an interesting, or it's a two words actually there that are interesting in the Hebrew. People debate over the translation of it. It really can mean the bridle of the city. And what it really means is this, the parallel, I believe, is, again, I don't have it written out, but I believe the parallel account of this battle or this defeat is in Chronicles 18. I may be wrong with that, but you can do your Bibles and study the Bible on the core. But it tells us that it's Gath. And you see, Gath is the mother, that's why they say mother city or the bridal. Gath is the place, though there are five cities, Gath is symbolic of the power base of the Philistines. Remember, David has fought off the Philistines from Jerusalem and such, but they're still in the territory. And so what he's saying is he's finally dealt with a contemporary enemy of God's people. He is bringing peace, the peace that was promised, at least as a typewriter, that was promised to Israel. And it's David's battle that wins the victory. And by the way, when we look at the battles, it says later that it says that God was with David. It says God's, when it says with him, it says he saved David. When we read these six verses and then the two other verses, they're very short. But it was probably a lot of war going on. But the emphasis is that God is with him and saving through his work. So that's to the west. And then you find Moab. He defeats Moab. Moab to the east. And we have this interesting discussion, this account here. In this account, we see this interesting thing of making these lines, like these ropes, and lining these people up and killing two-thirds, but sparing one-third. Again, what we have here is holy war. And what we don't know exactly all the details here. But look at what happens here. And the Moabites became servants of David and brought tribute. You see, this could be, when we think of the Moabites here and the Edomites, different from the Philistines, the Moabite and the Edomites are relatives of the Israelites. Remember? They have what we call questionable parentage, at least from our ethical standpoint. Remember Lot and his two daughters. And Israel is commanded not to attack them when they went into the land. They were not the ones to be displaced because he had promised them that land. But if you remember when they came in and Barak called Balaam, and then through the prophecy of Balaam, it says that God would raise up a scepter to strike Moab. And maybe David is this. But even in that judgment upon Moab, we see a glimmer that some become servants. There it's not complete holy war. Kind of like what God had said to the Israelites about the nations that are around them that they go is try to make peace with the city. But this peace here is submission to the king. And then we have up to the north, Zobah, and then ultimately the Syrians and the Arameans. By the way, Hadadazar is a name that means Hadad is a help. Hadad is a pagan storm god, kind of like what Baal is, another one of those pagan storm gods, probably Syrian. So, Hadadazar, this king who says Hadad is help, fights. And notice here's the extension. We're told that he went to restore his power at the river Euphrates. Look how far north David is. The river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 foot soldiers and hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. Israel didn't have chariots at this time, but he hamstrung them. We know that account of Israel hamstrung their chariots in the book of Judges. But it shows the victory. And then we're told, and when the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadazar, they came to help the one whom their God had helped. See, that's the little kind of ironic twist. They came to help. They had a greater defeat because they struck down 20,000 men of the Syrians. And then David solidified his power to the north by placing garrisons up to the north. Think about the promise to Abraham. It focused on the north and the south river and the north, the great river Euphrates. And again, just like the Moabites, they brought tribute to David and became David's servants. And David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants and brought them to Jerusalem. And he brought bronze, and this is a great victory. This is the extension of the holy land, of the holy territory, to the boundaries that God had promised long ago to Abraham. We're finally finding them find fulfillment in David. And then jumping to verse 13. By the way, we will look at other passages in coming weeks, We're told that David made a name for himself. And look at the content of verse 13 and 14. You see how what's being told there is very similar to the first six verses? This is the fourth one. And David made a name for himself, and he returned from striking down 1,800 Edomites in the Valley of Salt to the south. Then he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom, he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became servants, and the Lord gave victory to David wherever he went. Holy war. Making a name for himself. Now, interesting history lesson. Should we read this and make those two errors I mentioned? Should we read this like some who say this is God deal with Israel, has nothing to do with us? You know, Israel and the church, the Old and New Testament completely ripped apart? No. But should we make the other error and say, here we have principles on how we are to live as we continue to grow in the church and continue to have effect upon the culture, we should engage in these holy wars like they did in the Middle Ages. Or not the Middle Ages, wherever that time. Like they did during the conquest. You see, there are those in the Reformed faith who do believe that. They want to tie the church to the state and believe that as the church influences the state, we should enact good laws, and if you're the Mosaic laws, and as we convince more and more people, we're going to be expending. What they're doing is holy war, brothers and sisters. They may be a nice way of doing holy war. They may not be putting the sword on, but they say you should tell the state to put the sword on and kill the blasphemers. You've heard maybe the term theonomy with big T, or Christian Reconstructionists. That's what they want to do. Brothers and sisters, they're not correctly understanding what's going on in the Old Testament and in David's day. David is a type of his greater son that we have. And his greater son, Jesus Christ, will bring judgment, will bring holy war. But when? Remember I said that in the typological Holy Land that Israel was in Egypt for 400 years? Why? Because the sins of the Amorites were not yet complete. There is a day, as Paul says, that he will judge. The day is not now. There is a day in which every knee shall bow. In that final day, even the enemies will bow to Jesus and pay tribute. But now the day is that we give the gospel call and ask people to bow the knee. Not in the negative sense, not to be subdued in the negative sense, but to be subdued in that positive sense in worship. To pay tribute. We preach the gospel. Charismatic movement that you may, they have a term. It's not a great movement, but they used to have a term. My mother actually went into a Catholic charismatic church, and they used to use a term that I kind of picked up on. It's called being slayed in the spirit. You see, that's what's happening now. When we preach the gospel to people, they get slayed in the spirit, meaning the spirit cuts them and they confess. That's how God defeats his enemies now. We sang the glorious conquest for a reason. See, now we turn the other cheek. Now we preach the gospel. Now it's not a geopolitical kingdom. It's a spiritual kingdom. Read the New Testament. See how many times they're going out in holy wars. See how many times they're going out to kill the pagans. In the book of Acts, in the book of Hebrews, and many of the New Testament books, is there much killing going on? I want you to all say, yes, there is killing going on. But who's holding the sword? Who's holding the sword? Not the Christians. We don't hold the sword, brothers and sisters, and we don't tell the person who holds the sword that they need to work for us to bring the Holy Kingdom. It's interesting. The great sign of the Christian church is the cross. What's a great sign of Islam? That sword, what do we call it? What?
Scimitar.
We need to understand that our job as a church, our job as a people, is to preach the gospel. It's to speak of the coming judgment. One of my professors used to say that there are those in the church that want to jump the eschatological gun. I'll explain that, what that means. Eschatological means the final day. What he means by that is there are some people in the church who don't want to evangelize the mission field, the pagans that we run into, that live around. They want to kill them. There is a day in which God will bring them to that second death. But now is not the day. Now is the day of salvation. That's our message. And so we see that even in David. Don't we even see it in David? Didn't some of the people come to become servants of him? Yeah, it's not only some are put to death, but some become servants. The one thing that's tied all these things together, as I try to show you, at least from David and the land, that he is a promise to Abraham in chapter 15. Remember, that's why I said David is extending the promise that was given to Abraham. We read, as we speak about the promise with Abraham, when Jacob got the promise, by the way, wrestled it from his brother, the land, the promise, he had to leave the land. And his mother and father, Isaac and Rebekah, sent him away. But Isaac said to him, "May God give you and your descendants the promise, the blessing of Abraham." Of course, he was leaving the land. What David is doing is fulfilling the blessing of Abraham in the territory and in protection for his people. By the way, the extension of the territory was to bring peace to the people. But of course, we know that didn't last. Because again, it's a typewriter. It's a typewriter. But it has a message. We need to hear it. Because that typewriter is fulfilled in David's greater son that we see mentioned in 1 2 Samuel chapter 7. Turn with me now to the New Testament. I do want you to go these two passages. We're going to end with these two to, I think, really get us to see what's going on here. Galatians chapter 3, verse 10. I'm going to read verse 10 through verse 14. You see, David did bring the full extent of the territorial power to Israel. But though that is a type of the blessing of Abraham, it's not the real blessing of Abraham. It's a typewriter. And I'm going to go to two passages to show that to be the case. Galatians chapter 3, I'm going to read verses 10 through verse 14. "For all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, 'Cursed be everyone who does not abide in all things written in the book of the law to do them.' Now it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for the righteous shall live by faith. But the law is not of faith, rather, the one who does them shall live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, as it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree.'" In the Mosaic covenant, again, I'm not talking the Abrahamic covenant. I'm not talking about the Davidic. The Mosaic covenant, possession of the land, was ultimately based upon, and the blessing was the obedience. And what Paul is saying is, if you try to go back to that typewriter and try to do it by that typewriter, you're going to be in trouble. Look at verse 14. "So that in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham," that promised blessing of Abraham, which includes the land, "the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles." And we see Old Testament passages speak about that ultimately going. You know where first place where we see the Abrahamic covenant going to the Gentiles? The blessing of Abraham? At the beginning of the Abrahamic covenant, chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. He'll be a blessing to all the families of the earth. This is not new. This is not a reinterpretation. So that they might receive the promised Spirit through faith. By the way, it's the promised Spirit. It's not the Spirit that plan B. Finally, dealing with the land. I mentioned that the promised land is a type. It's a typewriter. God did not promise Abraham the land of Palestine, except as a typewriter. I'm going to mention two passages. For, as you're turning to Romans chapter 4, which is what I'm going to read, I'm just going to refer to the other one. Hebrews. We've been going through Hebrews in our Tuesday study. What city was Abraham looking for? It said he sojourned as a stranger and alien in the promised land because he was looking for a different land. That's what the author says in Hebrews. But look what Paul says in Romans chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. For the promise to Abraham and his offspring let me turn to my passage. My printer didn't do a good job. And if you want to read it. For the promise to Abraham and his offspring that he would be the heir of the
world.
Not Palestine. Not, and the word there is cosmos.
Wow.
When did God promise Abraham he would be heir of the cosmos? Read your Old Testament and find it. Well, the way I find it, because I understand typewriter computer. That's what Paul's doing. Paul's not coming giving you new revelation. He's giving you what the initial revelation meant. You see, brothers and sisters, the Old Testament's important for us to understand. It's these promises. And so as we read the kingdom given through David, it points us to ultimately to Christ. He's going to bring that ultimate judgment upon the world. And as what we can learn from chapter 8, and we'll learn more, this is, I would say, to my brothers and sisters who want to be reformed, and want to see the continuity between the Old and New Testament, which I commend them, but they miss the typology. They miss the typewriter computer. Who is it? In chapter 8, who is it that destroys Israel's enemies and brings peace? It's the king. We're going to look more into... You know how many times in chapter 8 the name David is mentioned? You're going to be surprised. 21 times. It's David who brings judgment. You see, because who brings judgment? Not Christians, not the church. Christ. He first comes, he will come as a lion and bring judgment. But now he's come as a lamb. He won victory. And of course, it's in that victory on the cross where he really defeated our greatest enemy. Your enemies are not the Republicans, Democrats, or independents, or your enemies are not even jihadists. The Christian's enemy wasn't Paul or Saul of Tarsus. And when Saul of Tarsus went before Agrippa or went before Festus and sought to go before the emperor, he wasn't going so he could defeat them, at least not in the jihadist way. He went with the power of the gospel. See, we do have a holy war. We're involved in a holy war. We cannot convert anybody. We cannot make this world Christian. How many times have you tried to make a relative, a friend, or someone else a Christian? Can't do it. But what you can do is you give them the gospel. You can pray to the Lord. They may hurt you. They may accuse you. But you're more than conquerors through Christ who loved us. Let us continue to, as we read the Old Testament, when we see what the King is doing here, understand, again, it is the author of Samuel preaching to us, Jesus Christ. Let's find our power in Him. Let us now go to Him and pray.